faster. Michael's going to start off telling us about how things currently work. Paul's going to come along later with brand new, fresh ideas to scale. Over to Michael.
So this is about making incremental updates using AppGreen. So this thing will be organized like this. I'm going to talk about what we have now, and then I will give a brief overview of what we want in the future. And then Paul, who's not quite here yet, but I hope he will show up, Paul will talk about all the cool technical details. He's really into it. So, what is the problem actually? Well, the problem is we are very successful. So we have a lot of users and a lot of developers, and they're using a lot of bandwidth on the network. So users update the system a lot, developers update the system a lot. And in the past, so on Sarge, if you do an upget update, you get a 4 megabyte packages file basically every time. Well, unless it hasn't changed, but if only a single package changed in this packages file, you get a complete new one. So a lot of bandwidth is used without a real good reason. And the other thing is that for the packages files, we basically have the same packages. If you upload and it's only a maintainer field that is changed, then you have to get a complete new package. So we waste a lot of bandwidth, really. What do we have now in Edge? We have pdiffs. They are around since a couple of months now, and they provide a mechanism to solve the problem of that we update index files a lot. So index files are packages and sources.tz files. And the idea is that instead of you download a complete new one every time, you just download patches. And we do this by having add-style diffs and an index file, basically. So it's a very simple mechanism. And this is implemented inside of app. So app will just have a look if there is an index file, pass the index file, and see what kind of patches it needs. A patch file, this is a patch file. It's, again, a simple thing. It's basically a script to drive add. The real editor, and it just says change this lines with this new value, or change this line with this new value. So it supports append and delete as well, but that's about it. We have three commands: append, delete, and change. We compress these files, so it's a very small file. And we also have an index file. This index file basically just lists what patches are available. These are the available patches. And what hash sums the packages files had before the patch was applied. So we just look at our system, see what hash some we have on our packages files or our sources file, and if we find a match, we just check what patch to download it, apply it, see if the checksum matches, see if the hash sum matches, and continue until we have either a valid packages file, or if anything goes wrong, we just skip the entire thing and download a new one. So this is how it works, basically. So, what is good about this? Well, obviously the patches are very small. It's in the range of 10 to 40 kilobyte, really. It's tiny compared to the 3 or 4 megabytes of the complete file. So, it's very good for people who update often. So if you update daily, you get 1 or 2 patches, basically. It's also very nice for people with little bandwidth, obviously. I mean, if you use a modem, then you really love this system. And the other nice thing is that we do not need any external dependencies. App just implements a method to apply these patches, and we are done. And this is what we have now in Edge. So now, what is the problem, actually, with this system? Well, for one thing, it only works with index files. So we currently do only support packages and sources.gz. The other problem is we need to keep a lot of patches around, because for each change we have to keep one patch. And in the past we had like hundreds of patches lying around. I think nowadays it's just 1 or 2 weeks that we keep actually. And it really does not work well if the indexes files are updated very often. For example, in Debian we used to update once a day, nowadays we update 2 times. And on other distributions like Ubuntu update a lot more often. They update the thing, I don't know what it is currently, but it used to be in the range between 24 and 48 times a day. So it's not working for a distribution like Ubuntu. And the other thing is we can't really use the same technique to work with Debian packages. Because for Debian packages, we would have to keep a patch file, a delta, for each version and for each architecture. So if we have 20,000 packages now, and we have 13 architectures, how many do we have actually now?
12.
So 20,000 packages multiplied by 12, multiplied by the number of patches we keep, we get a lot of files. And as far as I know, the FTP admins are not very keen on having a lot of files on the servers.
Also, you know how long it takes to run this on my server 30. It takes me 25 hours to run a daily update. So that's pretty problematic.
I see, yeah. So if we have these architectural issues.
Right. Well, not architectural issues, but yeah, I know what you mean.
So while we have a partial solution now, which is called PDIF, we do not have a complete solution. But we do want a complete solution. So what do we want? We want a unified method that works with index files, packages, and DDTP translations that are translated package descriptions. We have support for this in the Apptin experimental. We also want to not have to keep too many files around on the server, because again, the FTP masters will not like this. It shouldn't really matter if you update daily, or if you update weekly, or if you update monthly. It should just use what's locally available and get the minimum delta possible. We also do not want to require special server software or protocols, because mirrors just wouldn't install it, so we would lose our mirror network. And it also shouldn't require too much CPU on the server. Think of async. I mean, if you have a lot of async connections, it just kills your server. So these are basically what we want. And we had a summer of code project in 2006 by Felix Feiertag, which was about making something like this happen. And Paul will go into all the details. So this is really just giving a brief overview about what we did in the summer of code project, and the technical details will be done by Paul. So AppSync is a Python-based wrapper around Zsync, and Zsync is basically it's AppSync done on the client. So the load on the server is very minimal. The server does not require any additional software, it just needs an HTTP server. And what AppSync is doing, it computes the delta of the stuff you have installed in your local system, either by taking an old dev archive or by taking the installed files on your system. Then it computes a delta for this and then asks the server with HTTP range requests about the stuff that it needs. So we only need HTTP on the server and one additional file per package or per index file on the server. So it's about as minimal for files as you can get. There is an apt method called apt-sync, which is already available as a prototype. So you can write, instead of that HTTP archive, the whatever, or ftp.debian.org, you can just write deb upsync and ftp.debian.org if Debian would have all these required additional information. Unfortunately, the code is very, very much alpha quality. So it works for a couple of cases, but it, most of the time it just breaks. So it's really more a proof of concept as a real good working solution. But it's a very interesting thing going on here. And that was already my bit, and Paul will explain all the details now. Paul.
Thank you. So one of the biggest problems you've got is that when Elmo thinks that Delta upgrades are shit, then we have to convince him otherwise. Because he doesn't like them, right? As far as I can tell. I just get this slight impression. So here in Debian Ubuntu, we have a slight problem. We have a lot of users, okay? And we have a fairly distributed organization and a fairly distributed set of mirrors. So what's Debian? Well, you know what Debian is. And Ubuntu is a fairly good rip-off by this guy called Mark Chopperworth, who was floating around on the International Space Station and decided he would rip off Debian. So there we go. Right.
Well, you on that.
Well, he doesn't employ me, so you probably can. One problem is that all these users want to fetch the very latest stuff. They like the latest crap, and they tend to do it at the same time. Now, what happens when millions of people do something at the same time? You get slight issues, like saturation, basically. There is only one solution to avoiding saturation. Saturation is when you've got too much, you know, you've got a pipe this size, you're trying to put this much to it. There's only one solution, and that is to send less bits. You have to send less bits and bytes to the client to enable them to get the latest crack, and they'll be happy. So, this won't come out on the video, but the current way that we try and download a file is we we create a new file. This is your traditional wget download. You create a new file, you carry on downloading until it's the right length, and when it's the right length, you finish. Now, apt improves on this downloading technique slightly. The problem with that, apt improves on it slightly by having a checksum available. In the packages file, we also have a checksum of what that binary file should be when you've downloaded it. So we start a new file, we download it until it's the right length, and then we check the checksum. Now, if there's even a one-bit error in this, currently, we throw that away. Now, if this was Emacs or some other 45 megabyte download, then this is quite annoying, isn't it? Because then you've got to start all again. So BitTorrent. BitTorrent takes a slightly different technique. BitTorrent has lots and lots and lots of little checksums. It has a checksum for each, say, 256k or half megabyte. So it starts with a sparse file, a completely empty sparse file, and says, well, the first block, it's all zeros. The checksum doesn't match. I need to download that. So then it downloads that first block. Is the checksum okay? It's good. Right, I'll move on to the next one. And eventually gets to the end of the file, checksum matches, BitTorrent's happy. One of the ways to send less bits is compression. You can compress something. So right, this is the solution. We'll compress all our packages and then we'll send less bits. The problem is we already do that. So we need a better way. We need to save even more bits than we currently can do. So we need something that's even better than compression. Here's what a raw HTTP download and a compressed download do to your bandwidth graphs. So your bandwidth graph goes up quite steeply with a raw HTTP download until you hit the top of your giddy link, and then you know you can't serve any more users. But your CPU load-up goes very, very, very gradually. HTTP is a very low overhead system. As long as you've got the file in cache, so you know you need 4 gig of RAM or something on these machines, then you're fine. CPU load, pretty much the same for downloading a compressed file, which we already do. But you don't saturate as soon, because maybe you save 50% of the file on your site and 50% of your file sizes, so you can go a lot further before you run out of giggy. Now, what we need to do is delta compression, which is we need to take the files that are already on your hard disk and combine them with the stuff that's on the server. And then we don't need to download as much. Yeah. So we need to find out which blocks are similar to the ones on your server and which ones we need to actually fetch. This is delta encoding, or delta compression. So there's a current couple of solutions out there at the moment. There's one called Delta RPM. And Delta RPM, as far as I know, it takes the CPIO archive out of an RPM. And if you have the requisite files on your disk, then it can apply a patch to that and make a new CPIO. You stick that back inside an RPM using the APIs, and you get a new Delta. You get a new package. But if one of your files is missing, then it can't apply a patch, because patches only work between two known versions, or they're fuzzy like a DIM. There's another method of doing delta encoding which you've probably come across. Who's used rsync? Oh, lots of you. You've probably used it for backups and things like that. What it does, it allows you to have two separate machines with data on them, and it, on the spot, tries to compare what's in the two files without actually transferring the content. It tries to work out what's the same in each of the files and then downloads the rest. So, when you're looking through a file, trying to find which bits are in the same file, they're not necessarily in the same order as in the previous one. Imagine if somebody tarred their thing up by alphabetical order one time, and then the next time it got tarred up by some other random means that meant the files are in a different order. All the file data is there, if only you can find out where the start and end of each of those files and the tarball are, rearrange them. What you ultimately need to do is say, well, I've got this A, and if you apply these set of operations, just like with the PDF, if you apply a patch, you get B. So we're trying to get from A to B by doing things. And we have three instructions available in something like your typical edit script. You have three instructions. You have add, which is about inserting data in. That's data that doesn't exist in the copy you've already got on your machine. That's literal data. You have to download it. There's no two ways around it. We have copy commands, which are about copying the data you've already got, either the data you've just downloaded or the data that's already on your machine. And when you get to the end, you need to know you've got to the end so you have an end of stream. So, who knows how rsync works? Oh, good, right. Well, some of you don't, so I'll explain it. Rsync works by taking checksums. So, rsync takes an MD4 checksum of the first 4K in a file, and it takes an MD4K sum of the next 4K in a file. And this is relatively quick. So your laptop just has to go checksum of 4K, checksum of 4K, checksum of 4K, checksum of 4K, sends that to the server. So now the server has got a bunch of checksums which describe what you already have. And it's up to the server to work out, does that match the file it wants to send you? Now, if you just compared the first 4K file in the old one and the first 4K in the new one, you wouldn't find it if they've been offset by 2 or 3 bytes. So what you have to do is you have to compare this MD4 sum at every single byte offset in the file. So you compare this 4K at offset 0 and at offset 1, and you see whether it matches any of the checksums. If it does, you're in luck. But this is quite CPU intensive. Right? It's really extremely CPU intensive, which is why rsync completely kills your server when more than, say, one person actually wants to use it at once. What if you were to turn this around, though? What if the server did the initial comparison every 4K and sent those to the client, and the client then searched the files on its hard disk to find those checksums? This means that the actual heavy work, all that 4K comparison work, every single offset, is now done on the client. More clients, more CPU available. If someone wants to make it faster, they go and buy one of your, you know, dual processor Opterons or whatever it was that guy had. Where's he gone? If you want to make it faster, you invest in more hardware, but it's your problem to do that. This means that the more clients there are, the more CPU is, it's completely distributed, it scales linearly. And the server impact, in fact, is zero, right? Because every time the server takes those 4K checksums to teach 4K offset, they're going to be the same, no matter who accesses them. So you can pre-compute them. You can cache them. You only ever need to do it once. In fact, you can move this to your build D to actually do the generation of the 4K checksums. It's a bit like preparing your .torrent file. That's taking a checksum of blocks in the file. So, here's what our graphs do between compressed HTTP and server-based rsync. What you can see is you can keep on sending stuff until you run out of giggy. Fine, CPU load, pretty low. But server-based rsync, you've got all this unused bandwidth here. And the reason for it is this, your CPU has hit the wall almost instantly. The CPU load has gone up far too fast. You've got this huge, big red block of CPU load, of server CPU load. This is the server, yeah. You've got this huge, big red blob of server CPU load, not very much on the client. Whereas with the HTTP, it's fairly minimal, but you use a lot of bandwidth instead. What we're doing is turning the question around. So all you guys got to positive, right? Now, you could have sent me all your home addresses, and I could have gone to Google Maps, and I could have worked out, you know, timetables, how every single one of you guys, this is what a travel agent does. It takes a lot of time. You pay them lots of money. They make a right kick out of it. I could have worked out how each of you people could get to Fosdem. But then it's a lot of effort on my part and no effort on your part. So by turning that around, I'm allowing you to all individually work out how to get your own way to the destination. And I'm not having to do anything. So this is effectively reverse rsync. It's done by zsync. You can also do it with rdiff. Rdiff has a couple of commands like create a patch, so it creates those checksums on the fly. You can create a digest, which is creating the checksums. Then you can create a patch based on those digests. This only works if you actually find a matching checksum. And then you can effectively use the rsync process, but back to front. It also works with unknown local versions. So whereas these patches have to specifically go between two known versions, rsync and reverse rsync work with any. And this is great. So reverse rsync means that we don't max out either our CPU or our network. We can take more clients. Compared to the other methods, we're sending less bits and we're not introducing a CPU load onto the server. Which is good, because we have an existing mirror network, which involves HTTP servers, and that's what's available. And it's mostly run by people like universities who have disk space issues and, you know, might get a bit stressed. You also have FTP admins who might get a bit stressed if you upload lots of extra meta files. So if we generated individual patches to get between, say, 0.7 to 0.9, and 0.7 to 0.8, and 0.8 to 0.9, then you've got this n squared set of patches. Right? It's quite a lot of files. 20,000 packages, how many versions, you know, just keep multiplying. You make sure you've got a very big number. And you could approximate this to the stress factor it causes to people. It's not nice. So our solution, what we're hoping to do, is entirely based on the client. This whole business would be really nice, right? It'd be really easy. We could just effectively think about how you do an rsync between a file on your server and a file locally. You just give it the paths and it compares them. But there is a slight problem. We already have compressed packages. Now, compressed packages work a bit like a butterfly in its wings. It flaps its wings in Africa and you get a hurricane in London or something like this. It happens occasionally. London's mainly known for rain, but it does happen. Even if you change one byte in a file before compression, after compression, the result is staggeringly difficult. So you can't compare the compressed streams. What you need to do is you actually need to uncompress it and then generate the checksums. So if we find a few matches, we can then decide that we want to go and fetch. Say we want to get a range from 1,000 to 2,000 in the byte offsets on the server. But when these were compressed, that range may have moved to, say, 500 to 815 or something like that. It's a non-linear mapping. And we have to store this non-linear mapping of how to get into the compressed stream. It's a lookup table. You have to be able to map from this point. I think I'm making you confused, because I think I might have missed. Yeah, so I'm getting confused because there's the slide which demonstrates this isn't there. And several slides that demonstrate this aren't there. So let's just talk about it. Right, compression. So you have this situation where you have compressed streams and you have a non-linear mapping between the uncompressed positions and the compressed positions. You have to store that in a lookup table, but it's a bit like, I had an example for this, but not. So this lookup table, you've got no choice, but it's an index into the file. It allows you to get to a sector. So it's like sectors on a hard disk. Sectors on a hard disk have a nice linear mapping. You multiply it by 512, and you can get from a byte offset to the sector number. When you want to fetch a sector, you have to fetch the whole 512 bytes, or 2K, or whatever the sector size is. You can't just get an individual byte from a hard disk. And it's much the same with compression. You can't just dive in randomly in the middle of a compressed stream. It'd make no sense. You don't know what state's the compressor in. Is it copying strings? Is it, you know, decoding a Huffman table? So you need this information about what state the stream is in at each position to be able to jump into it. But you can only jump into it at certain points. You can only jump into it where you've got a starting position in your lookup table that tells you the state of the compressor. One problem, of course, is that if you decompress the streams and then work out how to reconstruct the uncompressed stream, is to satisfy the PGP signatures that apt needs, you need to reconstruct it. Now, have you tried compressing a file with sort of gzip minus 1 and gzip minus 9? They both produce the same uncompressed output, but the compressed versions are different. It's non-deterministic. If you want to recompress something, you need to know the steps that were taken to recompress it. And there's only one choice about that. Again, you have to store them. You have to store them in a lookup table of what happened. So what we hope that our generic solution takes is basically a set of linear mappings. So these are things that, if you look at our file, it starts off with a header. There's nothing magic about that header, it's just data. After that, you've got a set of gzip streams, deflate streams, which are in the control.tar.gzip. And so you need to have a linear mapping up until the start of the control file, and then you need to have a deflate mapping, which tells you how to dive into the middle of this deflate file. And then you have another linear mapping, which is the headers that account up until the start of the data.tar.gzip. But it could also be a data.bzip too, right? So we need to also know how to jump into bzip 2 streams, which is actually a lot easier. Bzip 2 streams tends to operate in 900 kilobyte blocks. So each 900 kilobyte block is completely self-contained. That's effectively a sector. It's quite a big sector. It's about, you know, the compressed sector is going to be about 200k. If you need even one byte out of this, you have to download the whole 200 kilobytes. But gzip has a little more flexibility. We can actually dive into the middle of a gzip stream, as long as we have a starting point. because you know you don't know what state the stream is in. You don't know whether you're currently on bit position, bit offset zero. You don't know the phase, whether you're on bit offset 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So as long as you look up a table, it tells you where you can dive in and what state you should be in. You can jump into the middle of a GSIP stream. You also need the history buffer, the last 32 kilobytes, the window, to be able to carry on processing. But because we're always constructing a file from front to back, you've always got the data up until that point, so you've always got that window with you. You either found it locally or you had to fetch it from somewhere else. The reconstruction issue is the one that we haven't tackled yet. Things like X-Delta. X-Delta has an option. Again, it has this issue with compressed files, but it understands that they're compressed files and it will decode them and do the comparison on the uncompressed contents. But it states in the manual, we cannot guarantee to reconstruct the compressed version of that, so you might fail a checksum test. Which if what we're trying to do is transparently drop this into an existing setup where you might for instance download a bit of the file by using apt-sync and then you might carry on downloading using an FTP transfer or something. So we need to reconstruct it in a way that is identical to what the existing file is. That's the bit that other people haven't solved. The only way to deterministically reconstruct something that isn't is to store a list of the instructions of what happened. So you probably took different routes from Garda MIDI to here. The only way to record, it's not deterministic which of the routes you took, the only way to know which of the routes you took is for you to have a list of instructions that I turned left, I turned right, I went forward, turned left, turned right. Storing that takes space, right? To store all that space about how you got from there to here is a lot. But what we could do, we could ask Google Maps for a suggested route from there to here and compare it with your route. And hopefully some of your route will match this model from Google Maps. And if it matches, we don't actually need to store it. We can just say, oh, yeah, the model's good in this case. Yeah. If it's GSIP minus 9 that is our model and all of our instructions happen to match exactly the choices that GSIP minus 9 might have made, we can say, just use the decisions that our model would make. There's two compression algorithms which we have in current use in depth. There may be more in the future, but these two cover a lot of the needs we currently have. They are restricted to comparing, you gain most of your data. You gain most of the compression.
Sorry, can I just ask? Is it always going to be GSIP minus 9 because that's mandated by policy? I mean, is there more determinism than the compression level?
Well, what happens if the GSIP library gets incremented and its behavior changes?
Has that happened in the last 10 years?
As far as we can tell, no.
Is it worth worrying about then?
So, I mean, you can shortcut this business of the deterministicity if you also control the structure that created it, yes. So if you control the BD, if you control the build daemons, and you know that they use Zlim minus 9, you can. But for instance, the internal depackage, dev, construction code, chunks things up 8K, 2K at a time. The internal GZIP and the internal depackage dev construction code actually produces a different result to GZIP minus 9. Because it chunks things up. So you need to know the exact method that was used to produce it. If you run depackaged dev in external mode, where it uses the existing GZIP package, then it does work like that, yeah. But if it was constructed with the internal code, it's a hashif dev in the main file, then it's gonna come out different. But you can emulate that behavior, yes. And somebody else who tried doing this crack in the past few years ago did come up with a Perl script that basically does that. It emulates that behavior. Deflate is probably the world's most widely used compression algorithm. It exists in GZIP files, zip files, your PPBD uses it, your SSH session if you turn compression on uses it. It's used virtually all over the place. It uses two layers. One is string matching. This is finding duplicate strings. So if you find the word hello repeated, you don't actually have to spell out the word hello a second time. You can just say, look back 300 words and it's there. Copy that word. That's actually where most of your data comes, most of your data saving comes from. It comes from duplication. Be that a long string of zeros, or be that perhaps, you know, XML tags repeated, that's where most of your data saving comes from. The other step is Hoffman, which is making more common symbols have shorter code lengths, and less common symbols have longer code lengths. So if you have lots of zeros, you might give zero a 1-bit code, and you might give, you know, value 255 that you don't use very often, very long code, and then you can have, you gain by having lots of small things repeated, and lots of larger things, but less likely, less frequently. The BZIP2 stack is a little more involved. It doesn't use two layers of compression. It uses RLE, followed by the Burroughs-Wheeler transform, followed by move to front, followed by another layer of R to run length encoding, and then followed by Hoffman. And actually, it uses multiple Hoffman tables as well. So it uses six Hoffman tables, and every 25 bytes, every 50 bytes, chooses the Hoffman table that most well compresses the next 50 bytes. It's much more involved. And the problem is, there's more undeterministic steps of reconstructing. Whereas in deflate, the only undeterministic step is the string comparison. Hoffman, as long as you know the table to code symbols to bits, is deterministic. It's basically a translation. You know, you're translating ASCII into EBD or whatever. As long as there's a one-to-one mapping, even if they're in a different order, it's fine. The other steps in BZIP2 are deterministic, and we have to record the reconstruction information. I've run out there. Right. So the current state of this is that we have some crack code that was written by our summer of code student last year, which works as a proof of concept. It was actually possible to use distop code for this, but it's very hacky, it only works in some circumstances, and it's not actually a good solution. Working code to do exactly what we want doesn't exist, but hopefully we'll get around to it. One of the hardest steps I found in working on this project is actually understanding things like the random access and compressed streams. And in the end, my only way to actually understand that fully was to go and write my own decoders for GZIP and BZIP2. And as a result of having written that, I actually now understand those compression technologies and the restrictions on them. BZIP2 is fairly good. We can get into the compression. Once we've worked out which bytes we need, we then need to work out which sectors we need from the dev file on the server. Remember that we don't want to duplicate any information. We already have all the lib data we need. It's on the server in a dev file. We don't need to copy into patch files. If you have patch files, you're actually duplicating literal data. It's already there in the dev file. We just need to work out what offset it is. And then transform it, uncompress it, add it to our thing, and recompress it. In fact, you can just copy it directly as long as you can keep everything in sync. So, yeah, I've run out of steam. Any questions? Oh, lots. One at a time. Anthony.
Would it not take an awful lot of this complication to store the data in uncompressed format and then just let HTTP compression save your bandwidth when it needs to?
So HTTP compression needs server support. It needs server CPU.
Yeah.
Right? That's one issue. The second issue is if we store it on the servers uncompressed, it's going to be about 5 to 10 times bigger than our current mirror uses. So if currently you need 160 gigabytes, we now need 1.6 terabytes. Unfortunately, I think the mirror admins might say no. Would you? There you are, overall. Next.
In
parallel solution, does not also make sense to do what Edu's project is proposing of a method, a peer-to-peer method, to download the packages? It's a parallel, not replacing this approach, but not be also wise to have that method in apt-get?
So we can actually replace the last step, the actual fetching the data, we need to fetch it from somewhere. You're quite right. Currently, we expect that to be fetched from an HTTP server, but we could fetch it from BitTorrent as well. We just need to say, give me the data starting at this offset for this length. You can use FTP, you can use HTTP, you could use BitTorrent. The ultimate ideal in terms of saving bandwidth would be this technology, and then actually fetching the literal data from BitTorrent. Yeah, that would be perfect. But if we build this in, currently the current prototype for this code replaces the HTTP method, and we provide a new method called AppSync. That's the wrong place to be doing this code. We need to do it higher up the stack. We need to do it at the place where the is the file finished, have we got the right checksum level takes place. If we do it there, then it works transparently with whatever method you've got, be it a CD-ROM method, be it an HTTP method, be it an FTP method. You're just anything that's capable of fetching a range of bytes starting at offset will work, and BitTorrent's one of them.
But you need the blocks, like between the clients, applying the two methods. Would you have the same blocks between clients? If both clients are those not downloading the same blocks, the ones that they don't have?
You can only give something away over peer-to-peer if you've already got it. So as if you start from the start of the file, you need, because of the restrictions on gzip, you need to do this from the start of the file to the end of the file. If it wasn't for the gzip window, then we could just do it blop, 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 blop until it's finished. The improvement on BitTorrent, currently the problem with BitTorrent is that if nobody else has got the block you're after, everything gets a bit stalled. If nobody's got block zero, if you're all starting from zero and you all need block zero and nobody's got it, then it all goes to pot because nobody can give it you and it's just a hung parliament. But what if you had a backup from BitTorrent? What if the block wasn't found on BitTorrent, you just went to the mirror, the HTTP mirror, and downloaded that first block? Now somebody has that first block and can start giving it away. Ideally, the clients would have the sense all to go to the mirror for different blocks, and then they could all start giving it to their neighbours. So there's an improvement to BitTorrent. There's a couple of specs for doing this, one of which is more widely implemented than the other. But again, it's not something I need to worry about. It's an extension to the .torrent file, which also provides a URL. And that's a URL to go and fetch if you can't find the block on the peer-to-peer network. So that's still using HTTP, but it's there as a second resort if you can't find it on the mirror network. Ultimately, you can. I mean, I'm hoping that when this goes in, the bandwidth utilization goes down to say 30% of the current usage. Because of this business of compression sectors, there is quite a bit of overhead. Because if you want to, if you've worked out you only need to fetch these bytes, you still actually need to fetch maybe 2 to 50 times that, because you need to fetch the whole sector. But some ultimate combination of that, and I mean, it depending on what you're focusing on. If you're trying to get the absolute fastest download, then maybe CPU is available, maybe bandwidth is available. If you're behind a modem, then you know you're desperate. You want to save every piece of bandwidth, and you don't want to do it. So you put all these trade-offs in, and if it's faster to work out the diffs, then use the CPU. But if it's faster if you're on a gigi link, then it's probably faster just to download the file. Somehow we need to have a way of passing all these parameters to the engine and letting it choose what to do. But yeah, the ultimate solution is this running on top of an @BitTorrent method. And then the mirror admins will not even notice the bandwidth usage.
So what happened to the gzip -- r syncable thing that people have whittled about for years?
Right, so what gzip -r syncable does is this business of a butterfly's wings, okay? Every time you flap your wings and change one byte, the entire stream changes until you stop and start the stream. every time you stop and start the stream, you lose all the previous history. And as I said, you get most of your saving from finding things in the history. So this is the reason that LZMA, who's come across that, it's a new technology, it's a new, basically, GZIP, but instead of a 32 kilobyte window, it uses a 1 gigabyte window. Right? You're almost guaranteed to find that duplicate string earlier in there. But how the dash dash r syncable stuff is to make things line up every time. What it does is it keeps a rolling checksum of the last 4 kilobytes of the file. And if the sum of the bytes in that 4 kilobytes comes to zero, or any other magic number, the zero in this case, then it resets the stream. But what this means is that if every time you do this, chances are you'll eventually get back on step. If every time the set of bytes, your last 4k bytes add up to zero, it's going to happen, you're bound to get aligned after a while, right? But this means you continually keep on resetting the stream. Every time you reset the stream, you lose history. And so dash dash r syncable increases gzip by about 10% because it loses so much of the history. But it does mean that eventually you start to find matches in the compressed version of the stream that match up. What you could actually do is you could intelligently, if you were able to have the previous version and the new version of the file, you could actually intelligently choose when to reset the stream. So what you would do is you'd take your old file and you'd make sure that the compressed stream reset that's in that matched up to the new file. And around where you've inserted the extra bit of patch, you'd actually compress that as a separate block. And that's in a more intelligent way to use dash dash r syncable. It does that rather than this business of you just need both ends to agree when they're going to reset the stream for it to work. They just need to agree when to reset the stream and start again and throw everything away. The more often you do that, less efficient it is. It's a trade-off. It's not really a solution. It's branded about by people as being the solution, and it does work in some cases. Any more?
Do you have any statistics on how effective it is in terms of the savings?
So we got some initial statistics, which, I mean, if you've got an existing dev file, then you can find 100% of what you need to reconstruct in that on your local machine, in which case it's about 99%. Realistically, the current AppSync code, I think, was about 30% of the current bandwidth usage, and on very bad files, maybe 90% of the current bandwidth usage. But the problem with the current AppSync code is it doesn't intelligently restart the stream in the right places. It doesn't intelligently place checksums in the right places. If you've got a 5 kilobyte file, it takes a checksum of the first 4 kilobytes of that, and then it takes a checksum of the next 4 kilobytes, which is going to consist of 1 kilobyte of the first file and 3 kilobytes of the second file. Now, when you go looking for that on your hard disk, you're never ever going to find that. You're never going to find this 4K because, well, for a start, that 4K consists of information from 2 separate files. And so you're missing out the start and the end of all the files by doing that. But you could intelligently place these checksums. You could place a check from going from 0 to 4K and another checksum going from 1K to 5K. Right? And this would allow you to find this checksum at the start of the file and this checksum at the end of the file. And then you can start a new checksum at 5k where the second file begins. And by intelligently working out where to take the checksums from, that's where we should be more efficient. That basically just consists of understanding the tar format and saying, well, here's a new file. We'll start making new checksums from this point onwards. I'm hoping 20-30%.
And it requires one metafile per dev file.
Yes.
How big is the meta file?
That depends on the more checksums. It's basically about checksums. The more checksums you put in, the finer granularity of matching you have, the more space the checksums take up. So rsync currently uses 4K, but the matching code that I've written uses variable length. It's basically a generic decoder. It's like MPEG. MPEG doesn't define how you encode a file. it defines the compressed stream. So this means you can carry on incrementing the encoder to make it more efficient. You only need to define the decoder. And so what my hope is that we define the decoder that can take arbitrary length checksums. And then we can do all this, we can do all these improvements incrementally in the encoder, which is just a matter of updating the technology on the build demon. So we can do a first pass at this, which maybe, you know, is 60% of current bandwidth usage. And then by shuffling around and doing actually lots of research into the checksum placements, we can retrospectively improve this without having to update the software on people's machines. So it's like MPEG, okay? You can always decode an MPEG 1 stream, but people can carry on producing better and better MPEG 1 encoders, or better and better MPEG 3 audio encoders, but your current decoders still will decode it. And it's a trade-off between, I mean, you could make a file that really soaked the CPU, but it's your choice not to do that.
Hand wave estimate, for a 20 megabyte dev, how big would the metafile be with 4K checksums?
7 bytes per 4K.
What if it's 500?
Yeah, so one to 500, so. So, I mean, make it really bad. One, you know. It's. I mean, the current files are fairly small. They're basically torrent files. Imagine torrent files, but with more checksums. So maybe up to 10 times bigger than a current torrent file. So of course, what we can actually do is we could use checksums that align with the torrent file. So that might make some savings when if we actually move to app bit torrents as the back end as well.
In theory, you could have it so that the mirrors can choose not to distribute the metadata files if they want to save the disk space.
Mm. And it degrades really nicely. Yeah, you're right. If you haven't got the space, you don't have to distribute these. They are tiny. If the client can't be asked to download them, it has a CPU pad to do the computation. You know, if you're on a 6800, you haven't got the CPU to do all this checksum matching. Then actually you're better off not downloading it and using it. You're better off just doing an HTTP download. Because you probably, if you've got 6800, you've probably got more bandwidth than CPU cells. Anyway, thank you people. Maybe next year we'll be able to say we've done it. If not, we'll come back and we'll tell you why we haven't done it. Thank you very much.